Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 2, Crowley Golden and the Isis Heart, a tale of Egyptian revival, written and performed for podcast by MJ Hahn. Good evening. Welcome to episode 5, and thanks for tuning in. So, listeners, last time we became acquainted with the more nefarious characters in our story, and we got just a morsel of their dark and dirty dealings. Tonight, however, we're veering back into the light. Why don't we go have a look around the Golden family homestead, where I'm sure Crowley's 88-year-old grandfather Theodorus will have his own opinions about what's been going on around the city. There's a certain quiet corner near the top of Ashbury Heights, which has been occupied by the same rambling brick house since the earliest days of the city. By some fortune, in all that time, the house known as the Cottage has managed to remain in the same family as the man who built the house in the first place, namely Vernal Golden. Vernal had chosen the spot initially because of its picturesque and somewhat remote location, poised next to the hillside covered in eucalyptus trees. Vernal's design for the house, with its long, sloping roofline covered in sleepy chimney stacks, suggested something out of a storybook. Although, over time, as the neighborhood full of typical row houses had begun to spring up all around, Vernal's cottage started to look more and more out of place. The curiosity on the corner, the odd relic from another time. The secluded northern corner of the house had been dedicated for use as the repository for the Golden family's rather sizable book collection. The tall library shelves were filled to capacity with the countless tomes that had been added by each subsequent generation. Today, the only reader in the library was Vernal Golden's great-great-grandson, Crowley. Lying splayed across the beat-up leather sofa, with an enormous sleeping bulldog at his feet, Crowley had reread the same sentence at least 6 times, and it still hadn't sunk in.
I never had 1 hour's happiness in her society. And yet my mind all round the 24 hours was harping on the happiness of having her with me unto death.
The dense paragraphs of Great Expectations weren't exactly the sort that you could just skim over. They required a certain tenacious presence of mind that Crowley was currently having a difficult time managing. Despite his best efforts, the words seemed to skip away off of the page and drift elusively up into the air where they evaporated. Crowley reached over and checked his phone for the umpteenth time. Wilshire still hadn't responded to his text. Crowley grumbled, and then grumbled again for grumbling in the first place. He had gone and gotten himself pulled back in, sitting there waiting for Wilshire to get around to him. It had to have been hours since he had sent his urbane and witty reply to her usual and somewhat predictable message of, "Hey, hotness, what you doin'?" Crowley scoffed while he scrolled down through Wilshire's previous texts. He rolled his eyes, noting that they all basically said the same thing, although she did manage a slight variation in the word's order here and there, just to show that she really cared.
Ugh, my girlfriend is the prettiest robot in school.
It was during these little moments of clarity that made Crowley wonder what exactly he was doing wasting his time with someone like Wilshire in the first place.
It's not like we even have anything in common.
Wilshire was Miss Teen fashion personified, strictly a top 40 rom-com at the multiplex sort of girl. The girl who glazed over when Crowley described his most prized possessions, a rather impressive collection of 80s vinyl, as well as a complete set of autographed John Waters classics on original VHS. Ah, Wilshire. The girl who, despite being a San Fran native, had hardly ventured out into the city any further than the department stores in Union Square. What was Crowley doing with a girl like her? And yet, in spite of numerous attempts at convincing himself otherwise, Crowley had found it nearly impossible to resist the persistent lure of Wilshire Sutton. She buzzed around his head constantly like a sweetly scented hornet, coyly trying to hide its razor-sharp sting. Crowley glared at his phone again.
Ugh, why do I let her dog me around like this?
Eisenhower, the enormously beefy and somewhat flatulent bulldog, snorted awake from the end of the sofa and gave Crowley the stink eye for disturbing his nap.
"Oh, pardon me, Your Highness. I didn't mean to disturb you."
Eisenhower's meaty head reluctantly sank back down with a wheezy sigh.
"What's the matter, Aki? Is the big bad teenager bothering you?"
A slight, bespectacled man had entered the library. He was dressed in a vintage brown and beige velour tracksuit. The few surviving wild tufts of frizzy silver hair in his head were held back by an ancient red, white, and blue sweatband. A pair of old-fangled Birkenstocks finished off the ensemble by showcasing the man's rainbow-toed socks. He looked every inch the perfect picture of an authentic San Francisco character. Theodorus Golden beamed when he saw that his grandson was reading the copy of Dickens that he had suggested.
"Hey, did you get to the part where Stella stomps all over Pip and he just sits there like a doormat? Oops, spoiler alert."
Grandpa Theo paused upon seeing Crowley's sour expression.
"Oh dear, what's gone and gotten your knickers in a twist? Oh no, don't tell me. Little Miss Who's-It is too busy to talk to you again. Yeah, am I right?"
Crowley's lips twisted and he hid his face in his book. Theodorus shuffled across the room until he was seated behind his enormously crowded desk. He produced a cream-colored envelope from the velour pocket of his tracksuit and set it in the center of the desk blotter.
"I found this mixed in with the regular mail. It's got your name on it. Strange, though, there's no postmark. Guess somebody just dropped it off."
Crowley emerged briefly from behind his book.
"Yeah? What is it, GT?"
Grandpa Theo, or GT as Crowley called him, picked up the envelope again. He held it up so Crowley could see the curly handwritten script.
Looks like an invitation. Good quality, heavy paper, and you don't see calligraphy like that much these days. Somebody's made an effort."
Crowley sat up, looking genuinely interested. Eisenhower grunted at having his nap disturbed yet again.
"An invitation? Huh. That's weird."
GT flipped the envelope over in his hand several times, and Crowley smirked.
"So, what are you waiting for? Go on. I know you're dying to open it."
Before Crowley had finished his sentence, a letter opener had miraculously appeared in Grandpa Theo's hand, and the envelope was sliced open. A little chuckle escaped his lips as he read the cover of the card inside.
"Annual Sons of the City Banquet. Fifth Generation Award. Special Honoree Crowley Golden."
"I'll be. Sons of the City now, that's a blast from the past. They were a big deal back in the 50s, but I thought they had mostly died out by now. And a fifth generation award? I never heard of it."
Crowley reached over and took the envelope.
"There wasn't any return address?"
Grandpa Theo flipped the card open and then raised an eyebrow.
"Well, it looks like there's no question who it's from. Looks like the current chairman of the Sons of the City is none other than Randolph Sutton himself."
Crowley guessed that GT's tone was meant to imply something sinister.
What? He does all kinds of charitable stuff. It's all Wilshire talks about."
Grandpa Theo looked slightly less than impressed.
"Charitable, Oh, I'm sure the Suttons are the very salt of the earth. Perhaps now, anyway."
"And what is that supposed to mean?"
"Well, it's been a little while, but back in my department days, let's just say that I had a few run-ins with Randolph Sutton that weren't exactly altruistic."
"What, he was like some big-time gangster or something?"
"He'd have liked to think so. Little Randy Sutton was just a common thug. Nothing but your garden-variety hoodlum."
Crowley adjusted his position on the sofa, and Eisenhower grunted at the audacity of having his nap disturbed yet again.
"So, why haven't you mentioned this before?"
Grandpa Theo paused and phrased his answer carefully.
"Well, I wasn't sure it was worth mentioning before. Your father was so over the moon when you got into that school and everything. But I'm sorry, I can't say that I share his bizarre enthusiasm for the Sutton family, no matter how much money they have."
Crowley reached over to scratch Eisenhower behind the ears and happily changed the subject.
"And speaking of Dad, have you seen him around? Seems like he's been gone for days." "He got that right. Morty was out of here early this morning. He's been on duty almost round the clock since that kerfuffle at the Legion."
"And what about the Black Ankh? Do they have any leads?"
Grandpa Theo shook his head, looking discouraged.
"Nope. Those boneheads don't have a thing. You know, I did try to explain that I had come across exactly such a thing several times in my research, but he wouldn't hear any of it."
Yeah, no surprise there. Poor old Dad has a tendency to totally shut down around anything that veers into hocus-pocus territory.
You just said a mouthful. Poor old Morty is right. His only contribution to the family's supernatural legacy thus far is a wind-up Cadillac.
Hey, don't go knocking the juggernaut. That's gonna be my car someday. Good thing, too. Have you seen how much gas costs lately? Crowley's mood seemed to have improved drastically. It was just the easy camaraderie that flowed naturally between himself and his grandfather.
So what did you dig up about the Black Ankh?
Yes, the question of the Black Ankh. Well, it's pretty straightforward, and potentially concerning.
Grandpa Theo swung his desk chair around and reached over towards the bookshelf. He retrieved a weathered volume covered in cracked ancient leather. He flipped through a few pages until he found what he was looking for, and then ran his fingers down the page, which was illustrated with a large black ankh encircled by strange arcane symbols.
It's all here in Kirkendall's Apocrypha, the Crux Ansata, an ancient cult of the blackest necromantic arts. Their origins are murky, but the name pops up first around 1400 BC, sometime during Egypt's 18th dynasty.
I suppose it can't be a coincidence then that the ruby that was stolen was from back then as well.
Grandpa Theo looked pleased.
If only your father could make such astute observations, his life might be a little easier. There are several entries here about the Isis heart. Apparently, the ruby was central to all of the Crux Ansata's more sinister rituals. Ooh, I shudder to think.
Why? What does it do?
Grandpa Theo looked over his glasses at Crowley.
Well, among other things, it's supposed to bring the dead back to life.
No way. Really? Whoa.
Yeah, you got that right. And considering that business with all those poor souls formerly buried under the Legion of Honor, I'd say somebody already has demonstrated a certain flair for that. I can only imagine what's in store now that they have the Isis heart.
Crowley raised his eyebrows.
In store? What do you mean?
Well, that old forgotten cemetery under the Legion wasn't the only one in town, you know. They were all over the place, if people only knew.
Crowley chuckled to himself while Grandpa Theo continued to expound on his considerable knowledge of all the old cemeteries around San Francisco, as well as the eventual relocation effort around 1900. About how some of the deceased didn't make it onto the death trains bound for the little town of Colma, south of the city. In true cinematic fashion, only the headstones were moved. Then, of course, all the records were lost in the 1906 fire. Nobody was sure how many forgotten souls were still buried under the city streets. Crowley chuckled again. No wonder his dad always shut down around Grandpa Theo. Hocus-pocus territory seemed to be GT's specialty. When Crowley tuned back in, he realized that GT was basically talking to himself. The question seemed to have drifted to the mystery of the amethyst tiara theft from Bloom's Antiques. Crowley smiled. For once, the tables were turned. This time, Crowley had the answers.
So there's this girl named Tina, and I might have accidentally sort of set events in motion which may have contributed to that.
What's this? Another girlfriend? Oh, Crowley. How many is that now? And this one is a jewel thief to boot.
No, it's not like that.
Oh no? She's not a thief then?
Well, yeah, maybe a thief, but Tina's hardly my girlfriend. Tina's dead. She's a ghost.
Grandpa Theo paused a moment as if absorbing this.
Dead, you say? I didn't think ghosts wore tiaras.
Crowley laughed and filled GT in on a few Tina Bleiberman essentials, including her penchant for amethyst crystals, as well as her being caught in the sights of a certain silver pistol more than once. At that, Grandpa Theo's eyes popped.
What? You mean the phantasmal displacer?
Yeah, Vernal's crazy silver pistol. Tina showed up at the Legion the night of the break-in, and it happened again.
Again?
Yeah, I guess the energy boost from the amethyst wasn't a match for the displacer.
And this was when you snuck into the crime scene. Oh, Crowley.
Anyway, I recognized the shattered amethyst right away. I knew it was Tina's, so I used it to summon her back again. At which point, Tina stated, sort of vehemently, that she recognized her attacker. She said it was Derventer, and that he had shot her with the very same silver pistol.
Grandpa Theo looked thoughtful, like the dots were starting to connect themselves.
I'd be very careful if I were you, Crowley. Very careful indeed. I know you have a natural talent for this sort of thing, but I didn't even attempt my first seance until I was at least 20.
Don't worry, GT. Tina's cool. I trust her.
Well, cool or not, I'd still be careful.
This time it was Crowley's turn to look thoughtful.
Why? What's the big deal? The summoning part was easy. I did it from memory.
Grandpa Theo exhaled sharply.
And which formula were you using? Please don't tell me it was Trismegistus.
Crowley averted his eyes.
Oh, you lunkhead! What's wrong with you? I don't believe it. You don't know what you're dabbling with.
I'm not dabbling. It was just a general summoning. No biggie.
No, Crowley. If you're using Trismegistus and that loathsome blood chalk drawn into a star, you're not summoning ghosts, my boy. Oh, no. Mere ghosts don't reside in the places that formula accesses. And the displacer wasn't made for your run-of-the-mill spook, you know. It was made specifically for destroying evil spirits.
Evil? But Tina's not evil.
Yeah, the fact that you haven't been flayed alive yet could indicate that she's a sympathetic spirit. I wonder. You said she died in the 80s? Interesting. Bleeberman. I remember that case.
Grandpa Theo's eyes seemed to go slightly out of focus.
Years before, way back in 68, I remember a rather unpleasant man named Philgrave who approached me about some of Vernal's work. He said he had heard about Vernal's theories regarding energy transfer, but was vague about where he had gotten his information. Coincidentally, in those days I was working on something in a similar vein. Spirit energy transfer. Channeling and containing energy that's otherwise just swimming around out in the ether. Philgrave offered a small fortune for just a few pages out of Vernal's notes, more if I agreed to collaborate with him. In those days, we really needed the money, so I agreed. Let's just say that the partnership was short-lived. Something was shady. Philgrave was clearly not the man in charge, yet he was very tight-lipped about his partner. And then there were the notes written in a mysterious hand that Philgrave delivered, which indicated an intention for pursuing an altogether different avenue than I had expected. The device they wanted me to create went against the very laws of nature.
Yeah, way back when my mom was at Oddfellows, Philgrave and Derventor were supposedly doing makeovers in the basement of the Cursed Castle with that weird device. It was only dumb luck that saved her, though. But my mom's friends weren't so lucky. That machine harvested the youth right out of them. Only for Tina, it ended up being sort of fatal. Hence all the haunting.
Well, if Tina got overcooked in that mangled device, I'm afraid that now she's far from being a ghost. More like some sort of demon, I'm sorry to say.
Somehow I don't think Tina will mind.
And now our little demon is gallivanting around town wearing Derventor's mother's tiara. I guess there's some poetic justice in there somewhere.
Crowley's mouth fell open and went slack.
Did you say Derventor's mother?
That's right, my boy. None other than the Lady Blavatsky herself. It's all written down in Vernal's journals, which are still out in the workshop where your father left them, I believe.
Crowley grabbed his phone and followed Grandpa Theo, who had already shuffled out of the library. Eisenhower raised his head with a look of outrage. Then, realizing that the sofa was now entirely at his disposal, he snuffled approvingly and flopped back down with his stubby legs all akimbo. Crowley trailed GT through the cottage's central winding hallway that opened into the grand foyer. The faces of four young women looked out from their portraits on the walls, one for each of the Golden Family matriarchs, including Crowley's mother, Sloane. Crowley couldn't help smirking whenever he saw his mother's portrait. Somehow the artist had failed to include her trademark smudgy black eyeliner and spiky bleached Billy Idol hair. Instead, he had attempted to make her into some oddly grinning TV mom. Needless to say, there was no resemblance at all. The pair moved down a different hallway towards the back of the house. Here the walls were covered with framed news clippings from various solved police cases the Golden Men had been involved with. Vernal's son Ambrose had started the family tradition of law enforcement back in the 20s. Ambrose didn't exactly exhibit any of Vernal's tendencies for the, shall we say, eccentric. Ambrose was the practical sort through and through, without a spark of magic in him. It was only later, when Theodorus was born, that Vernal's unusual traits resurfaced. Theodorus's rather unusual childhood gave Ambrose the notion that this certain supernatural tendency most likely skipped a generation. And so it followed, when Theo started a family, his son Mortimer was just like his grandfather Ambrose, someone who veered towards the conventional, and would never even dream of opening a spellbook. At least Grandpa Theo could rest easy with the knowledge that Crowley had already more than compensated for Morty's supernatural shortcomings. The hall ended and opened out into a large, lived-in-looking kitchen. Grandpa Theo paused to pour himself a cup of coffee, and then crossed to the other side of the room and exited through the large French doors out into the garden. Nestled in the well-kept oasis of green was the vine-covered workshop where Grandpa Theo did his tinkering, as well as his other experiments which required a little more discretion. The heavy wooden door opened with a resounding creak as they stepped inside.
"Now where did Morty leave those boxes?"
Two of the workshop's walls were comprised entirely of tall, thickly framed windows. The surrounding ivy outside had become almost completely overgrown, giving a soft green tinge to the long fingers of sunlight that illuminated the dust slowly drifting downward. Crowley smiled at the piles of haphazard chaos that filled the space. Nothing had changed.
"I see we still haven't gotten around to that spring cleaning yet."
Grandpa Theo failed to offer a response while he began poking around. Crowley browsed along the room's perimeter in the opposite direction. Long work tables were littered with discarded electrical parts, scraps of notepaper, and various tools that were strewn about. Among the spare parts was a particular family invention that Crowley remembered fondly from his childhood. The old cathedral-style radio that had been converted to play spools of 8-track tape. Crowley felt along the back until he found the brass crank. He gave it a few quick turns and the radio came to life. A lilting 1930s tune filled the workshop. Grandpa Theo gave a start from the other side of the room.
"Holy cats! Nearly scared me to death! Huh, that old thing is still working, I see. Well, I suppose a little music couldn't hurt while we look around."
While Grandpa Theo went back to his search, Crowley spotted a large rectangular shape covered with a canvas tarp in the corner. With a little jolt of recognition, he was instantly drawn closer. Crowley's eyes lit up when he pulled back the tarp to reveal a glass display case. Contained within was a contraption made of shining brass and leather straps. It looked like some bizarre hybrid between a dragonfly and a jetpack.
"Whoa, Vernal's dragonfly!"
"Don't get too excited. The blasted thing never did get off the ground. Oh, look, here we are."
Grandpa Theo had finally located the appropriate box and had begun filing through the stacks of Vernal Golden's journals inside. Crowley immediately recognized the volume that GT had finally selected. The one that was just a little heftier than the rest. The one that he himself had skimmed through a few times. As Crowley crossed the workshop, he was able to read the gold embossed print along the spine that spelled out Coil House. Grandpa Theo licked his thumb and began flicking through the journal's pages.
"Now, if in fact we are dealing with the same Derventor that Vernal worked with during his early days, he must be at least 150 years old by now. Which lines up rather nicely with what's recorded about Helena Blavatsky's life. Vernal's notes refer to several conversations he had with Lady Iwanaga."
Crowley's eyes widened.
"You mean Yuki's grandmother?"
"Exactly. Another mysterious one. I won't even hazard a guess as to how old she was. Yet it seems that Vernal had the lady's confidence because she told him at least one story that she hadn't shared with Derventor."
"Dude, sounds like they should have their own reality show."
"Mm-hmm. You have no idea. So, picture it. 19th century Europe. All the blue bloods orbiting around each other in tightly knit social circles held together by rumor and gossip. And even though they tried to pawn it off as the age of reason, there was still plenty going on that was hardly rational. Secret societies full of crackpot mysticism, not to mention countless charlatans and snake oil salesmen, all experiencing a terrific vogue at the time. Gullibility was all the rage."
Grandpa Theo continued to leaf through the Coil House volume.
"Ah, here it is. Even though Iwanaga mentions only one actual visit that she had with Blavatsky in India, she did have all the dirt on her, shall we say. Apparently, the Crux Ansata were making a resurgence and recruiting new members. And while Iwanaga declined the invitation, Helena Blavatsky supposedly joined the order.
At least for a short time. But what about the Baron? The guy on the news said something about a Baron Derventer?
Well, the story goes that the Baron was already high up in the order when Blavatsky joined. The Baron was taken by her immediately. He showered her with gifts, and there was a whirlwind affair, resulting in twin boys shortly after. Eventually, this domestic arrangement didn't suit the Baron in the slightest. Though he did leave them the dignity of keeping his name, the Baron abandoned his little family and fled to Dubrovnik. And, unfortunately for him, soon after, the Baron mysteriously met with a rather unfortunate circumstance.
What, like he died or something?
Yes, falling into the Adriatic will do that very nicely. It was a terrible scandal, though. Iwanaga was implicated, but then the case was hushed up very neatly, like it never happened. Which leaves us with the question of the two boys. Clearly, one of them ended up here with Lady Iwanaga all those years ago. Very curious indeed. Here, see for yourself.
Grandpa Theo handed the open book over to Crowley and stooped to rummage through Vernal's remaining volumes.
So the guy that Tina saw was probably Derventer's brother? Great. Like we needed another Derventer.
Crowley absently flipped from page to page, having some difficulty deciphering Vernal's tidy and compact script. Then something written in the margin caught his attention. Crowley's eyes fell over the tiny heading. The Love Call. Bring your love to you. The cluster of words was written in Latin, the letters joined together by a curling script forming a small circle. Crowley scanned over the peculiar words until he found himself repeating them.
Orbis terrarum, vultum reus volo, aldo meus deligo volo.
There was a slight shimmer in the air, and Grandpa Theo's head suddenly popped up.
What's that? Did you say something?
Crowley set the open volume down.
Hmm? Oh, nothing. Just something that Vernal had scribbled down.
Before Grandpa Theo's face could register suspicion, Crowley's pants began ringing. Crowley fished out his phone and then smirked when he saw the caller ID. Wilshire Sutton. Grandpa Theo's brow furrowed with mild disapproval while Crowley cleared his throat and attempted to sound smooth.
Hey, I wondered if I'd ever hear from you. I thought maybe you'd lost your phone again.
Grandpa Theo rolled his eyes and silently cringed. Wilshire's powdery sweet purr slunk out of Crowley's phone and prowled across the room. Grandpa Theo shook his head when he saw his grandson's glassy and rapt expression.
Hey, hotness! What you doing? OMG, I'm so bored. Why don't you meet me downtown? You can buy me an orange mocha non-fat frap and maybe watch me go shopping.
Crowley paused awkwardly, realizing it was his turn to speak.
Oh, yeah, great. Sounds good. I can be down there in about 20 minutes, okay? Hello?
Hello?
Determined to keep his cool from shattering, Crowley returned his phone to his jeans pocket and began nervously smoothing his hair back. He mumbled something that sounded like, "I'll see you later," turned and promptly bolted out of the workshop before Grandpa Theo could even get a word in edgewise.
Kids today.
Theo turned, then observed Vernal's journal lying open where Crowley had left it. His eyes popped when he saw the circular inscription on the page. And suddenly, it all made sense.
Oh, he went and cast the love call. Perfect! What did you go and get yourself into now, grandson?
Theo snapped the volume shut and returned it to the box on top of the others. He made a mental note that the first chance he had, he would get Crowley to move the lot inside and file them away in the library. Theo's eyebrows twitched as a few other household projects suddenly sprung to mind. Just a few chores to keep Crowley out of trouble, and likewise out of Wilshire Sutton's pink manicured clutches. It was only shortly after, while he was returning to the main house, that Grandpa Theo heard the doorbell persistently ringing. He shuffled down the hall, then looked a little puzzled at the figure he could see through the leaded glass panel in the front door. A slender girl with long hair that blazed copper in the sunlight. He opened the door, then beamed from ear to ear.
Well now, if it isn't Miss O'Malley, this is a pleasant surprise. It's been far too long since we've seen you.
Theo's smile dimmed a little when he noticed Yuki's slightly dazed expression.
Oh, hi, Mr. Golden. Sorry to bother you.
Theo's smile melted away altogether replaced with a look of concern.
What's the matter, dear? You look a little green.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how I got here. I was on the bus, heading back home, and then I found myself here. Which is weird, because I'm pretty sure the bus doesn't run anywhere near the street. I'm not sure what's going on.
Grandpa Theo reached out and patted Yuki on the shoulder.
Aw, you poor thing. You're out of sorts, aren't you? You'd better come inside, darling.
A look of panic furrowed Yuki's brow, and Theo caught on at once with a little chuckle.
Aw, don't worry. My idiot grandson isn't here at the moment.
Sheer relief washed over Yuki.
Thanks, Mr. Golden.
The smile had returned to Theo's face, as if something else about Yuki's out-of-the-blue arrival had occurred to him.
Now don't make me tell you again. It's Grandpa Theo. Now get in here and let's see if we can get a hold of your mother.
Yuki paused, a little of the panic returning as Theo closed the door behind them.
Could we not do that? She's just started thinking that everything is normal again. She's so much happier that way.
Grandpa Theo reassured Yuki with a little nod.
Ah, well, I suppose the very least we can do is not burst her bubble, yeah? We do that around here quite a bit, as a matter of fact, and it usually works out okay.
Grandpa Theo led the way to the kitchen, where he set Yuki up at the enormous kitchen table with a tall glass of milk and a few of his homemade peanut butter cookies. After a few bites, Yuki was feeling much better.
See? There now. Peanut butter cookies work every time. Even for teenagers.
Yuki nodded. Everything was back to normal. Well, normal for Yuki, anyway. Even though she didn't know how she had gotten there, just sitting in the cottage's kitchen felt like a baby step towards maybe actually talking to What's-His-Face again someday. And then, with a start, Yuki remembered what she had been carrying around in her backpack for a few days.
Since I'm here, I should tell you about what I found the other day. We were going through some of Derventer's old stuff, and I found an old journal of yours, as well as a crate full of these.
Yuki unzipped her backpack and retrieved the two strange canisters, as well as the leather-bound journal. A look of pure shock and amazement lit up Grandpa Theo's face.
Now would you look at that? I thought I'd lost all of those. My, oh my, we do have a lot to discuss, don't we, Miss O'Malley? But first things first, now, why don't you tell me about this friend of yours called Tina Bleiberman that I've heard so much about?
And so, Chapter 5 comes to a close. Special thanks to guest voices on this episode, Leanne Parker as Yuki, and Tristy Taylor as Wilshire Sutton. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. For more information, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 6. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.